This is The Guardian.
Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new Thursdays on FX. Stream on Hulu. Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Should they just hand England the trophy now? An impressive got-the-job-done performance against Italy. Jude Bellingham pivotal ahead of the pivots. Is Harry Kane deceptively quick, or are Italy just honestly slow at the back? Italy did expose England a few times in the first half, but Gareth's boys were on it in the decisive moments, and now the Azzurri are sweating on a game against Ukraine. Elsewhere, San Marino score a goal. Unbridled joy. Damn those Danes for getting a winner, but it doesn't really matter. We'll round up the rest of the Euro qualifiers action and find out why Ireland need to lose their next game, something they should really be capable of. There's the build-up to Pascal Chimbonda's first game in management, and this panel should bring some much-needed balance to the anti-dog agenda that somehow made the edit last week. All that, plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Will Unwin, welcome.
Good morning, Max.
Hello, Nicky Bandini.
Morning.
And hi, Lars Sivertsen.
Good morning, Max.
England have qualified for Euro 2024 after beating Italy at Wembley 3-1. My favourite sort of weirdly meaningless tweet was from the Premier League that said, "Heartache against Italy at Wembley in the Euro 2020 final, but 828 days later," as if nothing's happened in that time. England beat Italy to book their place in Germany for Euro 2024. Lars, how good were England? I've seen words like sort of swagger and inevitability, and I thought it was good at the key moments, but perhaps not. I'm going to go swagger seems a bit far, I think.
No, I think good at the key moments is a pretty good assessment. It tallies with my feeling as I watched it. But there were moments of sort of nice, fluid, attacking football. I think the second goal was lovely. And certainly there were certain movements when they looked very good. But you know, Italy, certainly in the first half, Italy also did some things. It's just, I think the way our view and experience of a game can be sort of colored, not just by the outcome, but how it develops as the game goes on. Because England were definitely the better team in the second half. They were comfortably the better team in the second half. And so when you're the best team in the second half and you win 3-1, it's kind of easy to forget that it was a little bit more iffy before the break. But this is a team, like, I've got no skin in the game here. Like, I'm not a big England fan. I'm in that wonderful position of I've been here long enough and no one care about enough English people that I'm genuinely happy when they win. But I also have the sort of foreigner schadenfreude when they don't. So whatever happens to England, I kind of enjoy it. Absolutely, I'm happy whatever goes. But I do quite enjoy watching them now. Like, there's quite a lot of fun guys in this team. It's easy to get sort of, I don't know if... to get spoiled is almost the phrase I'm looking for here, because there's not that many years ago where, like, sort of England friendlies, not friendly, that's an interesting Freudian slip, England games at Wembley were just kind of joyless and boring, and you can kind of like hear the England band trying their best and the people being, no. This is a team that's kind of exciting to watch. I enjoy watching them. And then you got like Jack Grealish coming off the bench. So like, there's a lot of good stuff going on here, and I think English fans should really appreciate this team while they have it. Instead of, as some of them seem to do, spend all their energy on like the handful of guys in there who they don't really like, because that seems like a strange focus. England were good is the very abbreviated version of what I just said.
On the swagger thing, I think it's interesting because I think Jude Bellingham has swagger. I mean, there's no doubt Jude Bellingham has swagger. He's an extraordinary footballer. And whenever he's on the ball, you just think he's going to do something brilliant. And there was something in the second goal which felt like swagger to me, because it wasn't just what he did, which obviously creating the goal and then the run across the defence that makes a space for Rashford, but it was almost like his self-belief rubbed off on Rashford, because I haven't seen Rashford look that menacing in a long time. And suddenly, when Rashford was on the ball, you're like, who's this guy? Rashford is arrowing at the defence. He's got the ball. It was one of those feelings that as soon as the ball was with Rashford, you thought, this is ending in the net, because of that swagger, because there was something in his body, in his, I don't know, the way he was carrying himself, the way he was carrying the ball in that moment, that just felt menacing. And so I think that's where the swagger comes from. I agree basically entirely with what Lars just said about the two different halves and how the game went, but I think there were moments of swagger that came through.
It's hard to think of new things to say about Jude Bellingham, isn't it? And I'm still sort of amazed he's 20. Like, that seems ridiculous, but I suppose, you know, you've seen that before with, like, I mean, Gazza is the perfect comparison when he was, what, I don't know how he was in Italian, 1919 maybe, but it's that vibe, isn't it? It's that total just belief in yourself and the, you know, the beauty of youth yet to be ground down. I'm not saying specifically you are ground down as a person, Will, but you know, that is something, you know, hopefully he still has that in 10 years' time.
Yeah, don't worry, I'm quite ground down. Yeah. kids do that to you, don't worry. He's got that to come, probably. I think obviously with the Rashford thing, he was probably just quite excited to play alongside a central midfielder that could run. So it was quite novel for Rashford, really inspired him to do a bit of sprinting himself. With Jude Bellingham, obviously with anyone that naturally talented, you know, they're going to go a good way. But if you look at his influence yesterday, the penalty where you're having to put that extra yard in to know you're going to get taken out, for the Rashford goal where you're running, making that run, knowing you're doing it for your teammate to make space, you're not always going to get that with the best players, the level below elite, where they have all the talent, but they just don't have that extra yard, that extra bit of energy to do it for everyone else. Whereas Bellingham is obviously playing for everyone else. The confidence it must give you to go to Real Madrid, you know, it's not overtaken him, it's not overwhelmed him. He's really taken it in stride, as you can see, you know, with his La Liga performances. I'm always considering getting a subscription for La Liga TV for my 14 subscription for football. And that's it. And as I say, he's so comfortable. If you watch the interview after the match, he's just had an incredible performance against Italy in front of a packed Wembley. He's very relaxed. He's very chilled. He speaks very well. He's joking with Zola. Oh, it's exciting to see that someone is so comfortable with that pressure that he is in. It doesn't seem to show it, as you mentioned, Gazza, obviously various aspects to it all, but probably didn't cope with the pressure of being that exciting generational talent, whereas Bellingham is. And if you look, you mentioned in being good in the key moments earlier. That's generally what international football is. Mm. It's not very exciting. And you look at the best teams over the past, you know, decades and decades in major tournaments. The teams that win generally have someone that can stand out. England have always been solid and a little bit too reliant maybe on Kane to take a half chance or something like that. And when he's not scoring, England struggle. But now you have those players that can take the game by the scruff of the neck. You have Bellingham. You have, like, the Foden touch yesterday to kick off that move. You have all these players that actually can make the difference when the rest of the team's solid, which generally England haven't had previously. So it's an exciting time for England. And, obviously they'll blow it next summer, but that's fine. enjoy it.
I sort of wanted to pick up, I don't know if I'm getting too hooked onto this swagger word, but I think there's something in the habit of winning, in the confidence that comes from the habit of winning. And England, perhaps, maybe I'm being too in the moment, I'm going to forget times when it's been like this before, but I look at some of the key players in this England team and they're positioned right now in teams that have the habit of winning. Think about Harry Kane going to Bayern Munich. I already can feel Tottenham fans coming for me on this one.
It's okay.
But you're going to a team that more than Tottenham has the habit of winning, right?
Like, you have the defence of truth. You have the defence of truth here, Nikki.
And I know it's not been perfect for him in Bayern, but I still think I don't know, I look at this England team and I think, gosh, when was there last an England team where you look at perhaps the two single most important players, not that there aren't plenty of others, but Bellingham and Kane, and they're playing not in England at teams that are dominant within their domestic context and dominant internationally as well. And then add on to that, that right now Manchester City are dominant in Europe and you've got players like Foden in the team. There's a lot of winning habit in this England team, and perhaps more than there has been often in the past.
This would be a point that would be laughed by everyone on social media. But I have this thought and theory, and I've spoken to people in the past where this makes sense. With Bellingham and Kane next summer going to Germany, where Bellingham played for Dortmund and Kane is in the habit of winning, as you say, with Bayern, feeling comfortable in your surroundings is very important, and having that level of comfort where nothing next summer will be a surprise to those people of where they're playing and things like that will actually help England, and having those players with those experience will help everyone else in it. And obviously you've got people playing the Champions League, like, but not everyone in the England squad is playing the Champions League. And so having Kane and Bellingham, who probably won at most of the grounds that will be featured next summer, is going to be important for England.
Lars, there's one conversation that will be had a million times, not just by us, but by everyone, as we get closer to the Euros, is the double pivot, right?
No.
And does it seem sensible to actually have that? Now you have someone in the 10 who is so brilliant, and you have someone in front of them who scores buckets of goals, and you've got a plethora of people wide. There will always be people saying, oh, we don't need a double pivot, let's just have one, and that'll be Declan Rice, who is quite attacking himself. And I'm not against having one pivot because I like attacking footballers like we all do, but is there actually some sense in that solidity?
Well, I think it does depend on the opposition a little bit. I think it makes sense to have like an extra beefy boy in there against Italy. That makes total sense. And you kind of touched on it then. If you have, I mean, hopefully for England's sake, he'll move somewhere else in January so he actually can play some football. But if you have a match fit Calvin Phillips, it does free up Declan Rice to do some things, because I've always been of the opinion that Declan Rice should kind of just focus on trying to be the English Rodri, because there aren't that many great number sixes in the world right now. But the reality is he does like to get forward a little bit. It's something he wants to do, seems to be, and it's something he can do. You know, he does add things when he gets forward and plays as more of a box-to-box sort of number eight type of guy. So if you're playing him and Calvin Phillips, that doesn't mean, as I've heard repeated many places, that you have, oh, we've got two sitters in it. But it's like, no, not necessarily, because Declan Rice can and will be encouraged to do a little bit more than that. So it's just adding a little bit extra solidity. And I think we've seen this in tournaments from Gareth Southgate before. He will adjust according to the opposition. What would be frustrating if you have like a group stage game against someone where you know you're going to have a lot of possession and you know they're going to sit deep and you use one of your midfield spots on Jordan Henderson. Like that, I think you're allowed to be frustrated if that happens. But this was playing Italy. This was a big boy game. So you pick the team accordingly. And I think it was fine.
And actually Arteta, you know, bought in Jorginho, didn't he? Against Man City, right? Which frees up Declan Rice a bit. Because I agree with you, he sort of gallops forward. I don't think you want him to be the sole person sitting, because he doesn't really sit. Nick says, why do you think Harry Kane has waited all this time to reveal he actually has blistering pace? He surpassed Bobby Charlton on the list of most goals for England at Wembley. He's up to 61 in 87 appearances for England. That third goal was not a sort of... Was that a very Harry Kane goal, Nicky? Or I can't remember. I mean, it was lots of Italian defenders not doing a great job at that exact moment.
Yeah, it wasn't a great defensive performance from Italy. I mean, there's plenty to say about the Italy performance. And I think on the pace thing, it's certainly watching it, you thought, I mean, come on, it's Harry Kane in terms of pace. But I think what you have to remember with Kane is he's been around a long time and he knows how to cover for his areas of less eliteness, I was going to say, rather than weakness, because I don't think you can call it weakness. And I think he uses his body very well. He shields the ball very well. He knows how to position himself and use what he does have to his advantage. That Italy defence was a bit of an odd hodgepodge. I mean, Scalvini, I'm very interested in. He's an exciting young player, but he's still a teenager. So give him time to work on things. Udoji, everyone's seen at Tottenham, has had a good start to the season. I think he's got a lot of promise as well. But again, you're talking about someone who's 20 years old. I think the whole team selection from Spalletti was a little bit surprising to me. And I think that it's not necessarily the strongest 11 that he could have chosen. And I think if you wanted to be more solid in those areas, then perhaps a more obvious choice would have been to stick with as much as you could of the Inter back four that went to a Champions League. Actually, it's a back five at Inter, but you could take a significant part of it and use it in your back four and take the group that went to a European final together last season. But I understand the reasons for not doing that as well. And I think in this case, yes, they were certainly exposed.
Mm. Well, actually, Nikki, I thought Barella looked really good in that first half as well. And, when they got past the two pivots, I was like, actually, and obviously they took the lead. Adoghi had that good chance. They had moments. And it is worth remembering, they are under strength for lots of reasons, Italy.
Yes, and I don't know how much you want me to talk about the whole scandal that's going on in Italy, because that's obviously
a
huge story. Spalletti, just to, before we get to that, Spalletti has inherited a very difficult job, because he was given 3 weeks before the last two games, which were both pivoted in this group. Obviously, the group had already not started well, with Italy losing the home game against England. And he's wrestling with that drama, with important players being injured. Obviously, Federico Chiesa would start if he was available, with, frankly, a shortage of talent at some positions. And I do think it's a very uneven Italy team, because I think there is some real talent in this team. I think Barella obviously is, and I think that Cristante has played some great games for Roma. I think that in defence, again, Scalvini has a big future ahead of him. I think Bastoni has a big future ahead of him. I love Federico Di Marco, who didn't play in this game, and I think that's going to be a really interesting dilemma for Spalletti, how you include Di Marco and Udogi, who want to play in the same side of the pitch. I think there are some really talented footballers here, but there are gaps, and you have prepared for this game at a particular moment with two players who were involved in Spalletti's first two games in charge, Tonali and Zaniolo, who certainly would have been involved in these two games, being removed from the squad at no notice at all before the game against Malta. So it has been a complicated period. And I would say for Italy, oddly, this game did feel like a bit of a free hit, because actually, even if Italy win this game, assuming, as happened, that Ukraine are going to beat Malta, it doesn't necessarily change much at all for what's left for them in the group. Because, again, we're building assumptions on assumptions here, because Italy, as we know, do not always beat North Macedonia. But Italy's next game is at home to North Macedonia. And assuming they win that game, then regardless of what the result was here, the need for the final game against Ukraine would be exactly the same, which is that you need to win or draw, because it's head-to-head results to decide the group, and they only won 2-1 home against Ukraine. So even if they had a 3-point advantage going to Ukraine, if you lose there, it would have probably been the same sort of outcome. So this game oddly didn't make much difference for them in that regard. And I think that Spalletti absolutely still sent them out to try and win it. That's not an excuse. That's not so they weren't trying. I think he wanted to send his team out. He was challenging them in his comments before the game to not leave things to the last minute, basically. But I do think there is some circumstance around this game that perhaps meant you didn't see the very best Italy that you could see.
So explain what's happened with Tonali and Zaniolo, if you can.
So there's an ongoing investigation by the Turin Prosecutor's Office into illegal betting in Italy, which extends far beyond football. That actually goes to the fact the existence of these websites that are unlicensed by the Italian authorities, where people are betting, and the Turin prosecutors are conducting a criminal investigation to find out how that's going on, basically. But it extends to people who are betting on those sites. As part of that investigation, the police came to Coverciano, which is Italy's training base, last week, and they asked questions of Tonali and of Zaniolo. Clearly, that was quite an unsettling moment for the players and for the team, and it was decided at the time that they should go home, basically. As of right now, neither of them is in any way suspended from playing football. They could have played in these games. That would have been completely within the rules. However, the criminal justice will take its course, and as far as that goes, what their exposure is if they're found to have bet on illegal sites that aren't licensed in Italy, they could face fines, in theory, a prison sentence of up to 3 months, but it's a sliding scale, and that seems like, at the moment, a fairly unlikely outcome. More pertinent is that the sporting justice thread, and what that comes to is footballers are not allowed to bet on football. That's pretty standard, but certainly within the Italian Football Federation's rules, it's stipulated clearly that you're not allowed to bet on competitions that are governed by the Italian Football Federation, by UEFA or by FIFA. And if you do so, that's punishable by a suspension from playing of up to 3 years. And that's before you get into, did you bet on your own team? So it could be even longer if you bet on your own team.
And sorry, do you mean suspension from, like, could they, if that happened, would they not be able to play for Villa or Newcastle? Or is that a Premier League?
In theory, this is all in theory. I'm just explaining the extent of the law. If you're suspended for up to 3 years, the Italian Football Federation would apply that ban. And in the same way as we saw when the Italian Football Federation banned, for instance, Paratici, they would expect UEFA to apply that across UEFA-governed competitions. And therefore, yes, it would apply to the Premier League as well. All competitions that fall within UEFA's gambit, I guess, rather than governed by UEFA. But yes, no, they would absolutely expect that suspension to be applied across European footballing competitions. So it's a very real risk to the players of a suspension. And to get into it from there, there's been a separate case, Nicolò Fagioli, Serie A's Young Player of the Year last year at Juventus. He was also caught up in this investigation previously, and we've known that he's been going through the sporting justice process. And actually just yesterday, he effectively completed his plea bargain with the Italian sporting justice. And it looks like he's going to be given a 7-month sentence. So he's going to be suspended for 7 months from playing football, Fagioli, who's been playing games for Juventus this season. So this is big news already. Someone else who might have been, in theory, in Spalletti's plans. And that's clearly reduced from the maximum of 3 years because he's spoken to the authorities and said, I'm confessing everything. Here's what happened. Now, Tonali's approach, and it's taken a few days to get to this because his people weren't saying much. But yet, as of yesterday, we now know that he also intends to seek a plea bargain. He intends to say, yes, you know, I did bet. Both he and Fagioli are saying, effectively, we have a gambling addiction and we're acknowledging it. And this is a thing we want to face on. Fagioli's sentence, to be specific about it, it's 7 months suspension and an extra 5 months in which he's expected to give 10 meetings chosen by the Italian football authorities where he's going to speak about his problems and use it as a learning experience for others. He's also agreeing to attend therapy. Tonali has immediately volunteered to attend therapy. He wants to cooperate fully with the authorities. He wants to say, tell them everything in effect. And that should lead to a reduced sentence. But there will be a sentence if that's the path he's going down. And it will be a suspension from football. How long it will be depend on the details of what he's planning to say and will depend on whether or not the things that he says lines up with what the Turin prosecutors find. Because the Turin prosecutors confiscated his electronic devices, confiscated Zaniolo's electronic devices. But the expectation in Italy is, well, if Fagioli's getting a 7-month sentence, it's hard to imagine Tonali getting less. We don't know because we haven't heard anything said, but that is the expectation. Zaniolo is a case apart because Zaniolo's defense so far, this has come out through his lawyer, Giordano, is I did not bet on football at all. I might have done some gambling on illegal sites on poker and blackjack. If it's that, there's a good chance he might not face any sort of suspension. But again, all of this is between the Italian football authorities and also the Turin prosecutors who have the electronic devices belonging to both players. So you've got some corroboration that's going to go on between what Fagioli has told them, what the players are now telling them, and between what the police find, basically. But at the moment, it looks very much like Tonali is headed for a ban, and how long that will be is going to depend on the negotiation with the prosecutor. And Zaniolo's case is more open-ended for now.
Can I just inject that? According to the Gazzetta this morning, Tonali has admitted that he gambled on Milan games when he was under contract with the team, but in games he wasn't eligible to play in. But that is still a level of seriousness that seems to be quite more severe than what Fagioli has admitted to. So you'd have to think, with that being the case, and if it's confirmed to be the case, ban will be pretty significant.
Gazzetta said that Fagioli has acknowledged to betting on games involving Serie A teams, but said never Juventus games. And the reporting is that Tonali is going to admit that he did bet on Milan games. Again, specifically ones he wasn't involved in or that were not betting against Milan. But yes, and that would, under the terms of the Italian Football Federation's rules, there would be scope for that to lead to a longer ban.
Fascinating. Before we end part one, we want to say our thoughts are with the families and the friends of the Sweden fans who were shot dead in Brussels on Monday night. The qualifier between Belgium and Sweden was abandoned at half time. It was apparently the players that made the ultimate decision to abandon it. An evacuation of the stadium began just before midnight. The last fans and staff left at around 4 a.m. Around 400 Sweden fans spent the night in hotels under police protection. The attacker was shot dead by police on Tuesday morning. We've got lots of listeners in Sweden. It is another heartbreaking bit of news at a time when there's so much of that, and we send our sympathies to you, and we'll be back in a second.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Ben says, any news on a tour? Michael says, how much pressure is Will feeling in the lead up to the highly anticipated Will Unwin anecdote? Has he been rehearsing? Have you been rehearsing, Will?
No. I think it's easy to say it's a terrible anecdote. Just take off all the pressure. You've not even heard it.
No, I know I haven't. Yeah, I don't want to hear it. I want to hear it live. I want to, you know, I want my reaction to be natural here.
Yeah. Only Joel has heard the story.
He's okayed it. He's okayed it, has he?
Well, that was over what? That was over about two WhatsApps.
So. Oh, right.
Wow. Yeah, I'll embellish it.
Look, we'll put it in the second half. People will be drunk. It's fine.
Yeah, I'll be drunk.
13th of November at the Troxy in London. Ellis James, Troy Townsend, Filippo Clare, me and Baz. 15th of November in Manchester at the Royal Northern College of Music. John Brewer, Nader Manuha, me and Barry. And of course, the Will Unwin anecdotes. 22nd of November, Brighton. Nikki is there along with me, Baz and Johnny Lou. That is available around the world on the live stream. Tickets are selling well. Obviously, Bristol and Dublin sold out. As in Brighton is sold out as well. But I'm really bored of plugging it. So can you just get on with it now and just buy tickets, please? It'd be great to say they're all sold out and I'd have to stop sort of begging and scheduling tweets in the middle of the night. Go to theguardian.com/FWTour23. They are really quite enjoyable.
Which one aren't sold out again, Max?
London and Manchester. Yeah, so come on. Just sort yourselves out, please. Liam says, open the show with San Marino scoring. Seems unfair, says James, not to call up Paul Watson, considering the San Marino goal. Autumn Floric, delirious Paul Watson voice note at the top, or bust. Paul Watson tweeted, says a lot about my career that the closest thing I get to a work emergency is when San Marino score. Anyway, as promised, here is a voice note from Paul Watson.
There's only one goal we need to discuss last night. And it's Alessandro Golinucci, San Marino against Denmark. The corner comes in, ball falls to the big man, the captain, he takes a swing, he hooks it. Maybe there's a little deflection. Who cares? It's in the roof of the net. Absolute chaos. San Marino players piling onto the pitch, jumping on top of each other. I'm sure there's tears. It's a goal for all of San Marino. It's a goal for all 30,000 people sat on a hill that is a country for some reason nobody really understands. It's a goal for Gianpaolo Mazza, the PE teacher who coached San Marino for 15 years. He did 83 games, he only ever won once. It's a goal for the Brigata Maiona Gioia. It's the Never Any Joy Brigade. It's their fan club. They go to all their games. They've never actually seen San Marino win because they were set up after their last win 20 years ago. It's a goal for San Marino fan club account on Twitter, the guy that seems to be always on the verge of a breakdown who tweets throughout their games. I hope he's okay this morning. It's a goal, but it's a goal for all underdogs. It's a goal for all the fans who support teams so bad. People ask who you really support. It's a goal for those of us who support teams and who bring them just endless, unmitigated pain, like it's some kind of weird act of sadomasochism. And we just plow on and plow on. And it's a goal for all of us watching part-time furniture salesmen hitting the corner flag when there are eight objectively more interesting games going on. And it's all worth it for that one crazy moment of mayhem. Doesn't matter that Denmark scored again. They could have scored 10. We had our moment, and God knows when the next one of those is going to be. So, Forza Titani, this is for underdogs everywhere.
What a moment, Lars. I mean, like the San Marino fan account, which is it's great, you know, doing one of those OMG, OMG, blah, 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 yeah, blah, yeah. When they scored their goal, you know, we've all seen that again. San Marino fan account, we scored and we equalised against fucking Denmark. Fuck me. Excuse my language, by the way. Oh my fucking God. I love you, Alessandro. Alessandro, you goat. And it was just, it was just a great moment.
It was fantastic, and it was made, I think it was made more fantastic, if that's the thing you can say, by the fact that it wasn't like an 8-1 consolation goal. Like, they actually equalized against Denmark. Like, they were on even terms for 10 minutes, at least, against the Danes, which have been a pretty, pretty good team. And
in the second half as well, right? Like, it wasn't in the first half.
No, and Denmark only won 2-1 in the end. They could only get one more. You know, the Denmark really laboring to get past San Marino, which is awkward for them. But I mean, I think that makes it even more. I obviously can't speak for them, but if I was a San Marino fan, that would it really did. And I mean, Kasper Schmeichel kind of seems to have lost his rag a little bit here, because according to the Danish journalist Michael Sten Jensen, Kasper Schmeichel at one point shouted, and I guess in games in San Marino, you can probably hear these things, "Give me the ball, you fucking prick," to one of the ball boys against San Marino. He was kind of confronted by the Danish press after the game, and he said, "Well, you know, you say a lot of things during a game. This is pretty normal." But, you know, San Marino had Denmark rumbled to the point where Kasper Schmeichel was being abusive towards the ball boys.
And I look, Nikki, we're all in it for unbridled joy. You know, it doesn't happen often.
I'm all for this. I'm all behind San Marino. I'm sad for them they weren't able to get it across the line, but I don't think anyone there is sad at all because, 1-1 at the second half. I can't say I've watched this game, I'll be honest.
No, that's
because
okay.
There was another game on, but I was enjoying, as everyone else was, the reactions on Twitter to it.
Yeah, totally brilliant. Also in Group H. So Group H, Slovenia and Denmark are joint top on 19 points. Kazakhstan can catch them. They beat Finland 2-1. It was sort of winner stays alive for them. Richard says, not really a question. Please spend as little time on Northern Ireland as possible, considering since COVID we've played 15 competitive home games and won 3, scoring 11 goals, 7 of which were against San Marino. Not that easy, actually, it turns out. Kosovo and Cyprus. Yeah, they lost 1-0 to top place Slovenia. John says, can you talk about Northern Ireland's fans' reaction to Euro 2028, specifically Casement Park? Is there awareness in the UK of the issues with the stadium, or is it just assumed that it's already built and Northern Ireland already playing there? Yeah, I assumed that, and forgive me. It's situated in an area of West Belfast that has a predominantly nationalist population where many teams would support the Republic of Ireland as opposed to Northern Ireland. The amalgamation of official Northern Ireland supporters clubs have expressed their concerns about the safety of fans attending games at the stadium. They've also questioned what effect the choice of Casement Park will have on Northern Ireland's football legacy. Windsor Park, where Northern Ireland play their international games, has a capacity of 18,500, which falls well below UEFA's criteria of 30,000 for a European Championship. And so Casement Park was nominated instead. On to the Republic of Ireland. They beat Gibraltar 4-0. Gibraltar have lost all 6 games, scored naught and conceded 21. And they could keep their hopes of qualification alive, Lars, by intentionally losing to Netherlands. Here we go. This is fantastic.
Yeah, this is crucial. I mean, this is what... I mean, certainly as a Norwegian, I've found it funny just how many games, like how bad you can be and still have a chance of qualifying. It seems to be because through the Nations League, but it's gotten weirder with the Republic of Ireland because, of course, the way these things work is you have a ranking according to how you did in the Nations League, and where you are in that ranking will determine whether you get a playoff spot through the Nations League. But of course, for that to work out, what you want is for all the teams that finished above you in the Nations League to qualify directly so that they don't take one of the playoff spots from the Nations League. And in the case of Ireland, the Netherlands are one of the teams who did better than them, unexpectedly, in the Nations League. Whereas the Netherlands are now in a situation where they're not totally guaranteed to qualify yet. They beat Greece. That helped a lot. But this could still go wrong for them when they play Greece in the last game. And if the Netherlands were to lose to Ireland, which seems very implausible, the way Ireland have been going, it could that would make it worse. So I'm feeling I haven't explained this very well. The situation is basically Ireland really need the Netherlands, who are in their group, to qualify from their group because of Nations League shenanigans. So when they go out and play against the Netherlands, that's going to have to be one of the weirder team talks in recent international history. Stephen Kenny is going to have to... sit them down and just got to pump up the atmosphere and say, lads, you know what you've got to do here.
Yeah.
You know, our qualification hopes are hanging by a thread. Got to go out there and not put a performance in. We're all relying on you. Go out there and lose.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, Will, the advantage that the Republic of Ireland have is if they put in a flat, laboured performance and lose 2-0, no one is going to say, hang on a second, something's wrong here, are they?
Yeah, so I suspect Evan Ferguson might get dropped for that match on the yeah. risk that he's got the capability to score goals. Just rest him. Don't you worry about that. No, yeah. Evan. You chill out. We need you for later on.
No, what they should do is they should suddenly they just bring in Jack's boys of 1990. Ray Houghton is picked with Andy Townsend, you know, Niall Quinn and Tony Cascarino do a half each. And they go, listen, I just picked the best players at my disposal, says Stephen Kenny.
It is basically the football equivalent of that Father Ted episode, isn't it? With the Euro Song
My Lovely
Contest.
Horse.
Yeah.
It's the My Lovely Horse of football. You're absolutely right.
The team selection for the Netherlands game will basically should be the football equivalent of My Lovely Horse. Evan Ferguson, Chidozie Ogbene, you guys all have a rest.
They could always just pick the walking football team from that Father Ted episode. That would work, wouldn't it? Group G, Hungary held to a 2-2 draw by Lithuania. Serbia played Montenegro. They still played as Serbia and Montenegro as recently as the 2006 World Cup. That was the year Montenegro gained independence. Serbia won 3-1. Mitrovic got a couple. Dusan Tadic the other. Hungary and Serbia are basically through, barring something pretty wild. If that happens, Montenegro could feasibly catch one of them. Group F, Austria confirmed their qualification thanks to a 1-0 win over Azerbaijan. Ralf Rangnick's Red Army. Portugal beat Bosnia-Herzegovina 5-0. And Cristiano Ronaldo scored two more goals. Martin emailed a listener from Luxembourg here. I love Philippe. Naturally, but whenever he mentions how well Luxembourg are doing, we inevitably go on to lose, getting pumped 9-0 by Portugal, or as was the case on Monday, losing to a single goal in a decisive game against Slovakia. It goes without saying that deep down I'm delighted when Philippe tips his hat in our direction, but maybe as a way of atoning for his hand in our latest defeat, Philippe could explain to everyone how the Nations League qualification route to the Euros works that we've just had Lars Kreinick explain.
I mean, I just tried. I don't think I did a very good job of it. I mean, if we have any listeners left after that, God bless you all for still being with us.
Yes, I'm not ringing up Philippe now to get him to do that. Look, Scotland lost 4-1 in France in a friendly. They took the lead. Billy Gilmore scored. France won comfortably. It doesn't matter, which must be lovely for Scotland fans to hear. It doesn't matter how they do in the next game. They're through. They're there. They've made it. And that is just wonderful news, as Ewan Murray confirmed. I mean, you knew it had happened before Ewan Murray came on to confirm it to you. Unless this is the only, you don't watch any football and this is the only place you come to for your news. But that'll do for part two. Part three, we will do any other business.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Fred says, can we have an update from Paul Watson on the shenanigans at Mongolia, Afghanistan, World Cup eliminator? Look, we've already asked him for something. You know, poor guy's got things to do. Afghanistan won 1-0 in Mongolia, 2-0 on aggregates. I think that means Mongolia are the first team out of the World Cup. So commiserations to them. Big VAR news, everybody. Darren England and Dan Cook are returning to Premier League duty for the first time since the debacle at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. They were stood down for two matches that same weekend, excluded from the following round of fixtures. Darren England gets the big gig, fourth official of Brentford Burnley. Dan Cook, assistant referee of Sheffield United, Manchester United, also on Saturday. And Simon Hooper, who was refereeing, will function as the VAR for Newcastle's home game against Crystal Palace on Saturday. Yes, Will.
Do you know where Darren England was last night?
Was he in Saudi Arabia?
No, he was in Brentford already. He was fourth official for the Soccer Ashes. The Subway Socceroos versus the All Whites of New Zealand. Yeah,
is that right? Okay. Yeah. And did it go? I mean, Australia won 2-0, but did it?
Yes, it was.
Did it go off without a hitch?
He got all the substitutions right. The numbers, the green and the red. He was good. He's back. He's back, England. He's primed. He's back. He's going to be good again.
Do you know, we probably shouldn't have brought it up. We should have just left him alone. Poor bastards. You know, there'll be enough people watching him, hoping something goes wrong. Now, Will, Pascal Chimbonda news. You are off to see his first game in management.
Yeah, I'm off to Bursko later tonight. He is managing Skelmersdale, but Skelmersdale play at Bursko.
Tough place to go?
Very tough on a day like this. It's horrifically windy. I did go to Bursko about 20 years ago to see Mosley beat Skelmersdale, because Skelmersdales were playing there then. And former Man City striker Leon Knight scored twice. So I'm hoping for something similar tonight. Chimbonda has said he's influenced by Guardiola and Mourinho and Simeone. So it's going to be an interesting style
fusion
to see from... Yeah, from the Northwest Counties League Premier Division's bottom side, who've won 1 in 16. They're playing against Kendal Town in the Macron Cup. But yeah, no, it's very exciting to see. You know, Chimbonda's, he did drop down to play in non-league at a similar level for a couple of teams when his career was winding down. So he's been open to it. He's had an academy in Manchester for quite a while now. He does one-on-one training sessions, and you know, I think he said he couldn't get a job anywhere else. So, you know, good for Skelmersdale. It's given them a hell of a lot of publicity, and good for Pascal that he's very willing to take it on. It's going to be a tough job, you know, looking at the stats and whatnot, and we'll see how it goes later on.
No, I mean, I think you make a good point. It sort of sounds fun, and it is for those reasons, but also it is hard to get in, right? It is really hard to get in.
Yeah, he's got his UEFA license. He's put in the hard yards to say. He's had academy, and his academy has put in players into the non-league system, which is, you know, shows that he's doing some good work, you know, based in the Northwest. And yeah, he's got to take a job somewhere, and this opportunity came up. And you know, if you improve Skelmersdale from being bottom to third from bottom, he's done a good job. But it's going to be a lot of hard work, and you know, it's the classic. It's a long way from playing for Tottenham, and you know, he was in the World Cup final squad for France that lost to Italy and the Zidane headbutt. So, you know, I might see a few more of those later. But yeah, it'll be exciting to see, and good luck to him. It's going to be a hell of a challenge, but his eyes are wide open. And the fact that he did drop down to play in non-league shows he's got an idea of what it's going to be like.
Where is Bursko and where is Skelmersdale? I mean, obviously I know, but for our foreign listeners.
Skem.
Yeah. Sort of,
so Liverpool way, I think, would be the easiest way of describing it. I'm sure someone will message him and bemoan my brief description, but bottom line, Google if you want to know.
I wish we could say that more often on this podcast. It's just whatever. Oh, mate, just Google it. Yeah, just Google that.
I was going to say, could answer pretty much every question I ask to that. Yeah.
To be fair, after Lars's description of the Nations League qualifying rules, I think there's going to be a lot of people Googling answers today.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's entirely fair.
Robert says, which MLS team is Lars looking forward to watching as the playoffs begin?
Well, it's the thing about this, because I've tried to... Well, I've done two things this year that have impacted my MLS watching. One of them is that I've written a book, and the other one is I've been making an effort to sleep at the right times of day. The conventionally considered right times of day, obviously. So I haven't watched it as much as usual. But stuff like St. Louis winning their conference and like Cincinnati winning the supporters' shield. I'm like, what is happening in MLS this season? So I definitely will make an effort to watch more of the playoffs, mainly to watch those two teams who I would, you know, in my ignorance and in my not having watched it properly this season, I'm still a little bit going, what? So I'd like to know what's going on there. So yeah, FC Cincinnati and St. Louis.
I'm excited to see St. Louis playing in an MLS playoffs. There was such a like, because when I was there, it was before they had a Major League Soccer team, and there's an actual like real soccer culture in St. Louis. It's a city that was ready for it. And yeah, getting to see them having won the division, won the conference. You know, I'm going to get my kickback as well. And going in having favourites from the West. I'm super curious about how they're going to do.
Yeah, my incredulity is not so much by the fact that, well, it is because they're an expansion franchise, right? It's their first mm-hmm. season, and we don't often see them do that well. So that is quite fascinating, and it's been very neglectful of me to not follow it more closely, but I'll try to set aside the time for the playoffs for sure.
I was about to read them out, but they seem like there's a lot of them.
Yes. Yeah, many teams in the playoffs, just not Inter Miami.
Right, okay, so there's... So this is the first. Is this the first round of playoffs that are just about to happen? Is Inter Miami, Charlotte? Is that the first one?
No, Inter Miami are still playing because they had some games postponed because of the League's Cup. Right, but I don't think they can reach it. Is how ignorant I am of MLS goings on this season. I think I might have to have my sort of honorary MLS correspondent tag taken away from me.
Currently there's no one fighting for that role. Perhaps we should get in touch with Leonardo Bonucci's South Dakota podcast.
That would be good. Yeah,
hopefully are more across it. Has anybody, having just watched the David Beckham documentary, we haven't talked about it at all, you know, is his big face appears whenever I get onto Netflix and want to watch the next series of Alone. What is it like, Nikki?
You haven't watched it? Oh, I really enjoyed it. It's a window into many things all at once. Obviously, it's a window into David Beckham and his career, and you get insights into his relationship with Sir Alex Ferguson, insights into his relationship, well, his relationships with all sorts of people in football and how they led to the different moves he made in his career. I think it's, for those of us of the right vintage, it's a fascinating look back to the 2000s and the culture of that time and some of the things that went on in terms of how the paparazzi behaved that I think have changed. I think those things are really interesting. I think it's a really human insight actually into the reality of someone who was obviously wasn't at the beginning, and that's also part of what's interesting about it, became a genuine global superstar, but started off as quite a shy kid from a very sort of close family. And I think it's also, in that regard, a really interesting insight into Victoria Beckham as well and who she was. And I think the family dynamic is one of the things that I personally found most interesting, because a lot of the decisions that get made about the moves he takes in his career, such as going to Spain, are not as straightforward as I think football reporting wants them to be. And I think football reporting focuses everything on the footballer and what they need and what they should be doing. And the consideration of actually what it is to be a parent and to have kids and to be living apart from those kids at certain times and just the impact on your life of those things and how it can change things. I don't want to sort of try and recount it all, but I think there's some chapters in his story that feel very different, seeing them from his and again from Victoria's perspective as well, to how I would have perceived them at the time. And of course, it's a documentary viewed entirely through one lens. It's his story, but there is an extraordinary cast of interviewees that join in with that. I mean, every sort of major football figure you can think of from that period has a voice in it. I found it really, really interesting. It was one of the most enjoyable of those sort of limited series on Netflix that I can remember.
Right. Well, I wasn't going to watch it, and now I will watch it. So I'm glad I asked. And actually, producer Silas said, should we ask this? And I was like, does anyone care? And I was wrong. For the record, I was wrong. A lot of people asked about, Philippe quoted a musician and writer called Robert Rotifer, who had written an article about the right to speechlessness when we were discussing football's reaction to Israel and Palestine. It is in German, but I will tweet out a link. I went then sort of through Google Translate. My German isn't what it was in 1997, let me tell you. But I went through Google Translate, but you can't translate it all in one chunk because Google Translate has a limit. But I would really recommend you do it. It's a very well, measured and thoughtful article on a very difficult subject. Slightly differently, Jim says, what do the panellists think about the pod's recent shocking anti-dog stance? That 9th of October, it was me, Nadim, Paul McInnes and John Bruin. John Bruin, of course, did have some previous when he was attacked as a youngster by dogs, and it was dogs in pubs. It was because in the Football Weekly book, which you can buy, go to the Guardian bookshop, in miscellaneous dislikes on your player profile, John Bruin had said dogs in pubs. And it turned out that everyone on the panel was sort of in agreement. And we were all slightly worried that there would be a huge vitriolic backlash. And there wasn't, actually. But, you know, now for balance, I know very much that Nikki and Lars are, you know, in the are pro-dog fraternity. I don't know where... Will, where do you stand on this?
Don't care about dogs being in pubs. Don't want one as a pet. Don't particularly like them. Don't have time for them. But,
wow, don't have time for them. Good Lord.
No. Next door's dog keeps jumping on me and licking me. So if my neighbour's listening, stop it.
Yeah.
Stop it.
It's the entitlement of owners who just laugh when your dog licks you in the face when you're lying in a park was what I said. But I didn't want to get even more anti-dog. Nikki, Lars, please, just for some balance. Because you can't, you know, I remembered, you know, there was that sort of list of... US presidents, and they all had dogs until Trump, and it was just like, look, he's that bad, he doesn't have a dog. And then I thought, oh no, I'm in the wrong camp here. But Nikki, Lars, it's over to you.
With like perfect timing, my dog Ross has just like started threatening to woof at the door, like he's like looking at the door and giving it like a gentle pre-woof, which is what he does when he's thinking about having a big woof. Dog's the best. Why wouldn't you want like to come home to someone who just, no matter like what you've done in the day, thinks you're the best thing in the world? Like, it's amazing.
Yeah, I concur that. Like, I don't want to quibble with, obviously, Bruin's childhood trauma is a very sort of genuinely felt thing on his side. So that's all. We should respect that. But I do think the whole sort of, maybe I'm showing my sort of metropolitan big city elitism thing here by just saying, at least in the city, there are so many spaces where dogs are not allowed. If you go to one of the pubs where they are allowed and you complain about the fact that there are dogs there, that's kind of a you problem, not a dog problem.
I did recently get kicked out of a pub for taking my sleeping daughter in. So if you want to go in for children in pubs, chat next time, that's fine. the barman helped me carry her in and then got to the bar and goes, oh, we're not allowed, you're not allowed kids in. So I was like... I was like, what did you think it was? I said, don't worry about it. It's a dog. She was asleep. I was like, I just want a quiet pipe. She's asleep. It's raining.
There is so much hypocrisy here because, you know, I have a small child and I spend a lot of time in cafes handing him a toy car and saying, look, show this car to that person. And he waddles off. And he's, in my view, indescribably cute, but that person could be on a deadline with a laptop and you can't say no when a toddler hands you a toy car.
But I mean, hopefully...
you're really awful.
Hopefully your toddler would not randomly lick strangers in the face, though, because that's maybe off-putting for some.
Sure, he's yet to do that, but still, it's the person in the cafe didn't go, has not requested the presence of a toddler, and yet I am, look, every 20 seconds off is like gold dust, right? So, you know, and it's good for his social development interaction or whatever. Good. I think there was some balance there. Thank you.
You know, toddlers and dogs, as long as it's the right dogs, can also be a beautiful combination.
Oh, he loves dogs. Yeah, yeah, that's great. That's a wonderful thing. No, I mean, I'm happy for him to be happy around a dog. If I'm lying down, my eyes closed, and one licks me in the face, and I don't just get a commensurate, I'm sorry, you might not have wanted that. That's all I want from the owner. You know, then that's the problem. Anyway, JT says, I'm missing Barry so much. I'm actually listening to the adverts to hear your chat. Wow. I mean, I feel for you, JT. But, you know, stay strong and it won't be long. And that'll do for today. Thanks, Lars.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Nikki.
Thanks.
Thank you, Will.
Cheers, Max.
Football Weekly is produced by Silas Gray. Our executive producer is Max Sanderson.
This is The Guardian.